And I imagine I have a question. Yes, I do. I was catching up on my Greek mythology while...
Oh, wait, of course you were. It's Friday, April the 12th, and this is the Dutch News Podcast, your weekly chance to catch up with what's been going on here in the Netherlands. I'm Gordon Darrow, Dutch News Contributing Editor and Badger Tunnel Intruder, and with me today is Paul Peters, Civil Engineer and Breach of Contract Killer.
I kind of hope that the job titles would be swapped, because I don't know anything about the Breach of Contract Killer, except
But you suggested bringing this up.
That's right, so. But I only saw the headline, so I thought, yeah, this is definitely a good... I was absolutely sure it was a good job title. I just didn't read into...
You saw the headline on Twitter, but you didn't actually read into the story.
No, exactly.
See, it's actually quite a harrowing story. I almost felt like once I read it that we should have to run it as a news story. It sounds like a very amusing headline when you're looking at it on Twitter, and it says that the headline, or even the top line, the story basically it was about a woman who hired a hitman to kill her husband, and then the hitman refused to do the job, and she went to court to try and claim the money back. Well, that was a headline, but actually when you dig into the story, when you read it through, it's a whole different kind of thing. It's she hired somebody to murder her husband because her husband had forced her into prostitution.
Okay.
So she the man that she hired then refused to do the job, and then turned around and blackmailed her and said, I'm not going to kill your husband, and if you instead of that, I'm going to tell your family and your friends about the fact that you've been working as a sex worker, I'm also going to go to the police, and I still have to pay me the money, because otherwise that's what I'm going to do. So she ended up being blackmailed by the guy that she'd hired to kill her husband, and in the end, because she didn't actually have the money, guess what, she was forced into prostitution again by this other guy. So it was actually a pretty horrible, awful story. And that was why she went to court to sue the man for blackmail. And part of the blackmail was that he'd taken this money that he was supposed to use to murder her husband as a way of forcing her into selling her body. So, awful story.
So a lot grimmer story than you would expect from the headline, because, as you say, it sounds like a very funny story, but
I feel almost terrible that this one was quite double tragedy. Got used for clickbait stories across the internet. So
In my defense, I didn't click on the story.
Only after we'd done the lineup for the podcast. But then I sort of felt duty bound to think, right, actually, this is where it's actually good to clear the air and explain that this is quite a harrowing tale, and not a piece of cheap clickbait. So be careful what you click on. I think is the moral of the story here. I'm turning into Gert Brechtman, I know. So let's lighten the mood and talk about badger tunnels.
I think on the podcast and in Dutch media as well, there were two constants, and that was outrage about badgers and outrage about wolves. And now finally the two stories, I mean, it was an inevitability, I guess, but finally the two stories have converted into something quite spectacular.
they finally converged into this lovely, wonderful double animal story.
Yeah, because badgers are a protected species, wolves are as well, but, you know, badgers are much more friendly, I guess, even though they have been
sabotaging. They tend not to bite sheep.
That's right, they do tend to disrupt train services. Well, we don't need badgers for that, we have great tits for that.
Exactly, the badgers are interfering with the great tits.
Wouter Koolmees, the CEO of NS. I was Koolmees again this morning,
again?
By the way. It's really turning into a habit. But badgers have been digging their... What's their nest called again?
Their sets.
Sets. They have been digging their sets underneath railway tracks and all sorts of problems, especially because they are protected, so they couldn't really do anything about these sets, or they had to do all sorts of creative stuff to get rid of these badgers. And in some of the nature areas in the Veluwe, there were special badger tunnels dug in order to allow badgers to move more freely between the nature areas that are completely fenced Belgian stuff for some reason. I mean,
yeah.
Is this because the Netherlands doesn't have any nature and is basically a huge park? Who knows?
It could be, yeah, yeah. So, but they actually have these tunnels are actually plastic tubes, right? Yeah. They've inserted into the fences at the bottom, obviously, so the badgers can crawl through and get to the other side, but no other animals can get through, or at least that's the theory.
That's the theory. And also there were some wildlife cameras put up because, you know, we don't have any nature, so we just... I mean, there are CCTV cameras for nature areas, right? Yeah. And all of a sudden there was, a special kind of animal species.
A special kind of badger. Yes.
Special kind of badger.
It wasn't striped. And
a badger in wolf's clothes was spotted because all of a sudden, it's quite a small tube, right? But this huge wolf appeared on the nightlife cameras and he just... dove into the badger tunnel.
Yeah, a very nimble wolf. It was kind of like wolf limbo dancing.
Yeah, exactly.
It wasn't a fully grown wolf. I think that was a thing that it wasn't fully grown, so he could just about squeeze through the tube. But you saw the wolf standing at the entrance of your tube, and you think you're never going to get through that. But he sort of just digs away with his paws and manages to get through. And I think the wolf rangers said they showed this footage to their colleagues in other countries, and they couldn't believe it. They'd never seen a wolf squeeze through such a small tunnel.
We have exceptionally smart wolves in the Netherlands. It's Dutch exceptionalism all over again.
Has spread to the wolves. Yeah. Just like the guy in the airport during Corona saying you're very smart people and very smart wolves.
Indeed. But yeah, the wolf has been a polarizing factor in the past years. So wolf opponents were outraged by this. We know we are... allowing wolves, we're making it easier for wolves to migrate from one area to the other, causing havoc among the lovely sheep that are standing on the grass fields. And even though I have to say that I thought when I first saw the video, I thought this is going to be the op-ed of the week, right? But then the op-ed was there wasn't that much op-ed, actually, I thought.
Not a huge amount of op-ed, no, but then towards the end of the week we were blessed with the fact that an op-ed that usually comes around about a month or 2 or 3 weeks from now arrived early.
Yeah.
What was that?
The traditional Dodehead Denking op-ed. In little over 3 weeks, on May 4th, the Netherlands will commemorate the deaths from World War II and peacekeeping missions thereafter on Memorial Day, National Memorial Day. There are hundreds of ceremonies all across the country at war memorials in basically every little town. The main event is the Nationale Dodenherdenking. It's held at Dam Square in Amsterdam, where King Willem-Alexander and Queen Maxima lay wreaths at the National Monument. Followed by 2 minutes of silence at 8 p.m. Have you ever joined the crowd in Dam Square?
I've never been to Amsterdam for the 2 minute silence, no. I've only ever watched it on television.
Mm. That ceremony always attracts thousands of people to the capital's main square. And that means that if you're standing in the crowd, you probably will not be able to see anything that's happening. But luckily, the 27 Hotel, which is located at Dam Square, came up with a solution. The hotel advertised on Instagram that only for €50 you could book a table at the hotel's rooftop bar.
Excellent.
Giving you an excellent view of the spectacle on the square below. There are no more gedoe, no more getrek in the crowd, the ad reads, but instead a comfortable view with drinks and snacks.
Yeah. And of course, inevitably, what snacks were they serving?
A bitterballer, of course. I was wondering, yeah. I was kind of expecting that they would serve the Anne Frank Borrelplank, but they didn't do that.
That was another great op-ed from years gone by. Yeah, exactly.
The advertisement understandably caused outrage on the internet. People thought it was distasteful and inappropriate to serve bitterballer and beers while commemorating victims of World War II. The owner of the hotel told RTL News that it wasn't his intention to make it sound like they were throwing a Dodenherdenking party. And he quickly...
But they were serving drinks and snacks.
Exactly. And, but not between tables, 8 and 8 p.m. And 2 past 8 p.m.
No.
He removed the ad from Instagram very quickly. He said that he understood the op-ed. He apologized for what they now realize was an inappropriate advertisement.
Yeah, and was it not the Dam Square where on May the 4th or the days before May the 4th that there was quite a big shootout with the last remnants of the Nazi occupiers as well? So.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Perhaps so even from the same building.
So that seemed to me, the idea of actually having people, you know, on a high building above the square seemed to be extra inappropriate. Like you could sort of reenact the, you know, the assassination of resistant fighters or something. So.
Oh wow, yeah, I haven't even thought about that. But yeah, that's that's true. That makes it even more inappropriate. Yeah, because or perhaps we should keep this for another patron special, because I think at the beginning of May we will have a patron special dedicated to May 4th and May 5th.
Yeah, the events around May the 4th.
I kind of enjoy standing in the crowd because, you know, not being able to see anything, that also means that you won't be able to see that awful national monument, which is one of the ugliest war memorials I've ever seen in my life. So I would prefer to not see anything that's happening over there.
Yeah. This week, the negotiations to form a new government grind on. They're likened to a puzzle and a marriage of convenience, and there's also a row over shit spreading thrown in. This is true. Yeah, a group of pensioners are taken to court for distributing a right to die drug. More cyclists are dying in accidents. Young Dutch professionals are paying through the nose for housing, and the absolute clusterfuck at Ajax intensifies.
Yeah, every time you think it couldn't get even more ridiculous than this in at Ajax, it does.
Something else happens.
Yeah, and I think we even have two devastating stories for Ajax in store for you.
But we start, as we have every week for the last 5 months, with the talks to form a new cabinet.
It really has been 5 months almost, right?
Almost,
yeah. It is insane. So I assume it's been so long, we are finally getting closer to a new government, right? Tell us that it is, that this is the case.
I'm going to have to disappoint you. Aww. Because the talks are going on behind closed doors. We don't really know what's happening. We have the spectacle of a politician's coming out after a day's meeting, being asked very elliptical questions and giving very vague answers to them, and no one's ever any the wiser.
Officially, the parties say radio silence phase, right? That's a that they're always having. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, officially the parties say they're optimistic, that there's constructive talks and that they're working hard on a deal. But then we look at what's actually happening and looking for the clues of what might be moving behind the scenes. All the signs are that nothing's really moving. And I think one of the big signs this week was that the four parties actually went separately to see the lead negotiators rather than sitting down at a table all together, which is what negotiations usually involve. Now, usually when you get sort of two parties, it sort of reminds me of when you have peace talks between two sides that are absolutely, you know, murderously against each other. Like when you have talks between, say, you know, the Israelis and the Palestinians, they actually sit in separate rooms and negotiators have to walk in between the two rooms because they won't be in a room together. It's not quite, obviously it's not at that level, but the fact that these four parties are not sitting down together and they're going to meet the negotiators separately, to me is a sign that it's not going that well.
To me it is a sign that the negotiators are just trying to do something unconventional because you know, they are aiming to get an unconventional government, and they're just trying to do anything, but from what else is coming out, the signs are not too optimistic, I think.
No. And there's an article in the Volkskrant this week where the sources said the reason that they'd held separate meetings was that they're really struggling to find any kind of compromise or common ground on the key issues, especially things like the environment and the climate change, because Geert Wilders says he doesn't want to spend another penny on climate change. He thinks the whole thing's a hoax anyway, whereas Peter Omtzigt says we have to abide by our international obligations like the Paris Accords, and the VVD are actually, one wing of the VVD is quite pro tackling climate change because there's potentially quite a lot of money in it. Anyway, but the one-on-one meetings, they were described as a confessional process. I quite like that. So I don't know who came up with this idea, but given that Peter Omtzigt has been described as a slippery Catholic in the course of this these negotiations, perhaps it was his idea. I don't know.
And especially strange because one of the confessors is a SGP politician. So that
indeed
makes it even more awkward. Yeah.
Yeah. Forgive me, Father. Oh, no, sorry.
Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. I'm a Roman Catholic. Yeah, you go straight to hell. I'm sorry.
Yes, I'm afraid, yeah, you're going to the big fire. The idea was that leaders would set out their priorities, but according to the False Grant, the four leaders all have different priorities and things like different emphasis. So some leaders will want to have... remember, the idea was that they were going to come up with a very short, sketchy outline agreement, but the more they talk about it, the more you find that party leaders want to have... are quite happy to have a sketchy agreement on one issue, but then they want lots and lots of detail on others. And it turns out that different... parties want detail on different issues.
Yeah, so we're especially going to end up with the topics they care about, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's funny that, yeah.
But this is exactly what happened last time, because as you remember, the last formation, the Rutte's fourth cabinet, they also all expressed the wish to have this, as thin an agreement as possible. But it ended up to be just as long as every time, because you know, this is what you do. You form a government. You make detailed agreements, and it is always the ambition, but it never happens.
No, yeah. So that's what I did. One sign that things are getting bogged down is that you'd be having these separate meetings. Another is what the politicians actually say in this, much as they say anything when they come out of the meetings. Because Geert Wilders this week, he was asked if he was in a positive mood, and he said, "That's a difficult question." Well, it's not really, is it?
It's quite a binary. Binary choice. When Geert Wilders is becoming nuanced, is a clear sign that things are going south.
Things are going terribly, terribly wrong. Peter Omtzigt was asked whether the talks were getting stuck in the mud. They were kind of stiff or awkward, or stroef is the Dutch word. And he sort of pondered a bit, and then he said, "Well, I don't know." But then he said, "It's a marriage of convenience at best." So not exactly a ringing endorsement.
No.
And then the two lead negotiators, I like this bit, they described it as a puzzle. Elbert Dijkgraaf then described how he liked to deal with jigsaw puzzles by doing the corners first and then the edges and then filling in the middle, which I think is how everybody does jigsaw puzzles, really, isn't it? Yeah. So there's nothing special about that. But then when the reporters asked Richard van Zwol, the other negotiator, where they were, he said, "We're definitely at the corners." In other words... They're just starting to put the pieces of the puzzle together.
So this all sounds like the parties are in the shit.
Well, yeah, in one sense they certainly are, because they fell out this week over a motion to actually try and spread a bit less shit around the nation's fields. Basically, the Netherlands has a surplus of manure. The EU wants to reduce the amount of farmers spread on their fields. This is all to do with nitrogen pollution as well. And the outgoing cabinet solution is to buy out more farmers. But that obviously has enraged the BBB, the Farmers' Party, who, of course, grew big on resisting this whole idea of farming buyouts. So they want ministers to go down to Brussels and lobby harder against plans for tougher sanctions and penalties. But on the other hand, the VVD and the NSA parties say, no, action needs to be taken now to cut emissions from manure. And that left BBB leader Caroline van der Plas all quite shocked. And she's now demanding explanations from the other two parties, who, of course, are also at the negotiation table with her through the daytime. And there are also differences over the future of the National Public Broadcaster, NPO. Geert Wilders wants to abolish it altogether because he thinks it broadcasts woke propaganda, while Peter Omtzigt's NSA, he wants to cut one of the three channels, and the other two parties just want to cut the budget. So again, different. I noticed that Wilders and Omtzigt both tweeted the same headline from the Telegraaf with sort of two very different messages, where Wilders said, let's have as little of this left liberal propaganda as possible, and Omtzigt said, we need to have a balanced, unbiased, neutral broadcaster, which is kind of the same thing in fancier words, I thought.
I think it was reported that this is one of the few topics the four parties more or less agree on. Everyone wants to cut one of the at least a bit of the 1 billion euros that goes to the public broadcaster every year. It's just they need to find a middle ground, because as you said, Geert Wilders wants to abolish it altogether, and others at least want to have some form of public broadcaster, but just in a slimmed down form.
Yeah, exactly.
But Geert Wilders is going on holiday, I believe. He's going to Hungary in a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, Hungary, one of his favorite destinations, because his wife is Hungarian and also his best friend in the European Union, Viktor Orban.
Yeah.
He's also going to share a platform with him at a conference that's organized by CPAC, which is a hardline conservative organization, a spin-off of the Republican group in the USA, which includes many supporters of Donald Trump, including people who support Donald Trump's claims that the last election was stolen and his efforts to seize power back by violence. Mm-hmm. The Hungarian edition has been running for a couple of years. American conservatives see Hungary as a kind of safe space, basically, where they can discuss their dedication to freedom of expression without being interrupted by anyone who disagrees with them, or by journalists, because reporters who asked to cover the event were sent rejection letters informing them that the conference was an anti-woke zone. And that caused quite a lot of op-ef and some criticism, although very mild criticism, from the other parties in the Kobanet talks. So when they were pressed on the issue, Peter Omdig, Caroline van der Plas, said she wouldn't have gone there, but Wilders was free to. Peter Omtzigt as well said that Wilders was free to meet whoever he likes, but he said, well, I would have chosen a different conference. But I sort of felt that left a sour taste in the mouth, not least because last year a journalist from The Guardian managed to get into the conference, but then they were manhandled by security guards and moved in the middle of an interview, actually bodily just led away, frog marched away while they were trying to interview the Republican Senator Rick Santorum, and that was condemned by the International Press Institute as an attack on media freedom.
Do you know what Rick Santorum once claimed about the Netherlands?
Yes, he did. He claimed that we were all killing all the old people. We were basically hanging do not resuscitate orders at the end of everyone's beds. Yeah,
and they were wearing, don't euthanize me bracelets.
That's right,
To basically as a begging all the wokists, I guess, who are killing elderly people en masse here in this country. Caused a lot of op-ed. He said it in a very small, tiny room. It was, of course, picked up by a Dutch person, and it caused an enormous outrage. I believe in 2008 or something, when he was running for president.
I think it was certainly one year that he was one of the candidates for president. But Peter Omtzigt, I mean, not so long ago, he was a real champion of press freedom. He led a review of Malta's criminal justice system for the Council of Europe. And that was in looking at the murder of Maltese journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. And the report that he produced was very critical of senior politicians in Malta. He criticized them for failing to secure justice for her, but also for obstructing the independent inquiry into official corruption and into threats against journalists. Mm-hmm. Whereas now Peter Omtzigt is quite happy to go and give a free pass to Geert Wilders, who has gone on record as describing journalists as the scum of the earth. So how people change when they get a sniff of power.
And we've also got some European elections coming up, and if you are living in the Netherlands with an EU passport, don't forget to register to vote. When is the deadline, Gordon, do you know that?
April the 25th.
Okay, great. We can always count on you of remembering these kind of dates from the top of your head. Yeah,
I know this registration system like the back of my hand.
Yeah. All right. The PVV is also making headlines when it comes to the European elections.
Yes, because Geert Wilders has produced his election manifesto for the European Parliament, and usually no one would care about that because the PVV don't do very well in European elections. But this time they're expected to get about a quarter of the votes, which is a big step up from last time when they got no seats. Yeah. And Wilders has formally dropped his commitment to Nexit, or withdrawal from the European Union. Now, the pedantic people will point out that the issue of whether or not a member state withdraws actually isn't anything that for the European Parliament to get involved in. But nevertheless, in the past, Wilders has included this in his European manifestos for the European elections. So I think it is kind of symbolically significant, especially as I said, the PVV are on course to take around 9 of the Dutch seats this time.
So the PVV, has been campaigning basically on two issues. One, the Netherlands should step out of the European Union. Actually, that's number two. The first item of business was always de-Islamize the Netherlands. Yeah. And ever since he has been elected to Parliament with 38 seats, he's dropped both of them. So
basically.
If you are a PVV voter, this would definitely make you extremely angry, and we would see this reflected in the polls, but that's definitely not the case. Voters work in mysterious ways. A group of 7 people aged between 70 and 80 appeared in court on Monday. They were charged with forming a criminal organization, and it's not 50 plus this time. It is a they are accused of supplying a suicide powder known as Substance X to the Dutch public. All seven of the defendants are either members or former members of African group Last Will Cooperative, that believes everyone has the right to choose their moment of death and has long campaigned for an end-of-life pill. The Public Prosecution Department believes the group worked together to distribute and supply the drug known as Compound X to over 600 people, with Loes de L allegedly leading the group. The unnamed powder is used in the chemical industry, and when ingested, it can take up to 40 hours to die, and was believed by the group to be a perfect way to give people freedom in deciding when to die. The public prosecutor, however, described the underground distribution scheme as excessive idealism. The drug apparently cost only 40 euros, and one 26-year-old man was heard as a witness in the court. He survived taking the powder after staying in intensive care for weeks, and a 28-year-old woman called the emergency services after she had regretted taking the substance, but she still died anyway in hospital. So a lot of people that have regretted buying this substance and taking it. It must be said that when we say that it has been distributed to over 600 people, that doesn't mean that 600 people have used it to commit suicide, but they have it somewhere in their house. It's basically waiting for them to take it in case they want it.
Yeah, so it's available if they decide they want to end their lives. But why were these people charged with forming a criminal organization?
Exactly? Yeah, because the public prosecution is saying that they have assisted suicide to all these people, and assisting in suicide is a criminal offense. And also they say that due to the scale of the distribution scheme and the organized way some members allegedly assisted people in giving them advice on how to take this substance in order to commit suicide, the public prosecutor characterizes the group as a criminal organization. The group indiscriminately provided the drug to anyone who paid, whether they were young or old, depressed or not, the prosecution service says. And the main provider of Substance X was a man called Alex S. He was jailed for 3 years for distributing the powder in June last year. He was sentenced to be involved in at least 10 suicides. And he was the person who provided also the drugs to Loes de L. And she then distributed among all these 600 other people across the country.
Yeah. And there are also two former board members of the Last Will Cooperative on trial as well.
Yes, but they distanced themselves completely from the rest of the group. They said that assisting suicide went completely against the purpose of Last Will Cooperative. They said, "We fought to make dying under one's own control possible. Providing help wasn't part of that." And the other suspects also believe it is very unfair that they had to appear in court. Someone said, "I wasn't aware that I was a member of a criminal organization, and I still am not," said one of them. "The picture is painted that we were making plans for an underground network, but that isn't correct." And we're gonna have to wait and see how the judges are feeling about this. This is a very long court case. It was scheduled to last at least 9 days, and it is exceptionally long. It will be we will definitely hear more about this ongoing court case.
Yeah, then we'll keep bringing you up to date in the next couple of weeks when it's concluded, and then it'll probably be several months before there's actually a verdict. We should mention as well that if you're struggling with thoughts of suicide or difficulties, then there is the suicide helpline available on either online at 113.nl, or you can call the toll free number 0800 0113. The number of people who died in road accidents dropped to less than 700 in 2023, but cyclists now account for nearly 40% of deaths on the roads, and that's double the proportion of from the early years of the century. The statistics agency, CBS, said cyclists were the biggest group of casualties for the fourth year in a row. 40% were over the age of 75, and 40% were riding e-bikes. The fatalities also included 194 people in cars, 78 motorcyclists, 53 people on mobility scooters. That seems a very high number. I mean, not that many mobility scooters around, are there? Anyway.
That's right, but whenever you see someone, be careful, because they tend to use it very recklessly.
Yeah, and 71 pedestrians as well.
So did this spark any suggestion that wearing cycle helmets might be a good idea?
It kind of did. Road safety Road safety organization Veiligverkeer Nederland said there was anecdotal evidence that more people are wearing helmets, although exact figures aren't available. Government think tanks said a few years ago that making helmets compulsory for children and people who ride e-bikes would save dozens of lives a year. Of course, the problem with e-bikes is that people go faster on them, and also people actually who older people cycle for longer at higher speeds, and these things are heavier, so if they fall off them, it's often got much more serious consequences. The Cyclists Union Features Bond, though, is dead against helmets. They say it'll promote the notion that cycling is unsafe, and said instead speed limits on urban roads should be cut to 30 kilometres an hour. Or perhaps he could do both. Who knows? That's a radical idea. But given we only made helmets compulsory for moped riders a year ago, I think we're quite some way from forcing cyclists to wear helmets. And I think, as I've said many times before, the right to cycle without a helmet in the Netherlands is the Dutch equivalent of the Second Amendment. It's just never going to get repealed, no matter how many people die.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a good comparison. Yes, I mean, I think that's even though I think the amount of resistance the Second Amendment get in the U.S. is much higher than the idea of compulsory helmets is
well, I think it's more extreme, because taking away your guns is more of a thing than telling people to wear cycle helmets or taking away your bikes. Yeah.
But actually a good comparison, I think. Yes. Yeah.
You don't need a helmet or any protective gear to listen to the Dutch News podcast, even if the progress of the coalition talks makes you bang your head against the wall. But if our coverage helps you insulate yourself against ignorance of what's going on in the Netherlands, and you can spare a euro or two a month, please consider becoming a sponsor of the podcast and supporting our efforts. Because it does cost us time, money, and love to make and promote these podcasts, and it's thanks to the generosity of our patrons that we're able to keep going. All new patrons get a shout out to say thank you. They get the chance to ask us a question and access to all our bonus content, including, of course, our upcoming special episode and all the previous special episodes we've done. And have we said what the special episode is about this time?
I think last time we said it. This time I don't think so. It's on the verzuiling, the pillarization of Dutch society, this mythical era in Dutch history that everyone keeps talking about. And we're finally going to explain what it actually entails, where it came from, and how it ended. Because it is a remnant of the past, but there's still it is part of the past, but there's still remnants of it laying around in Dutch society right now. So if you want to know what that is, which one of these items you can point at and say, oh, this is a part of the verzuiling, then become a patron and listen to our special episode that comes out, I think, on Saturday.
Yeah, fascinating insight into Dutch social history of recent times. You also, as a patron, and perhaps this is the most crucial thing of all, you get an extra vote or two in the Op for the Year Awards, depending on what level of membership you have. And that's which is, of course, one of the most unrepresentative and discredited democratic exercises outside of the PFF candidate selection process. This week, we say hello and thank you to new patrons Juanma MB and Nick Penisco, and a welcome back to David Zetland. Thank you for your continued support. Always nice
thank
to see patrons coming back. Yeah, David's also come up with a few good suggestions for future special episodes, so we're very grateful for those, and we may be working some of them in over the months to come. Joanna tells us, I'm looking forward to listening to your specials and learn more about this strange country, which excels in stroopwafels and gefilte koeken, but doesn't celebrate Shrove Tuesday. Pancake
What's
Day,
that?
Which
it's
the day before Ash Wednesday, the start of Lent, when instead of having, you see, in other countries people have pancakes for tea, whereas in the Netherlands people dress up in you have carnival instead, which is a much more extensive celebration, which where traditionally people go and abandon a goat or medium-sized animal outside a pub and then go and get drunk in it.
Well, this is only part of the Netherlands, and if you want to know which part, then listen to our upcoming Patreon special, because this is also a remnant of the Verzuiling in a way, I think.
So, I guess it is, Yeah, we also heard from Cyprian Grindiano, who became a patron last week, and he tells us he's just moved here 2 months ago. He's a software engineer from Romania, and said, "I was recommended by a friend to follow Dutch news." I don't know if that person's still a friend, but anyway, thank you very much to you and your friend. He says, "You helped me to adapt here. Thank you. Best wishes and keep doing the awesome work." So thank you for your contribution as well, Cyprian. If you'd like to join our exclusive band of patrons and enjoy all the benefits of membership, and there are 4 tiers, which basically depend on how much you're able or prepared to donate. But if you'd like to join, then log on to www.patreon.com/DutchNewsNL.
4 Dutch cities are in the top 10 most expensive European cities to rent a home, according to research by rental property website Housing Anywhere. Amsterdam tops the international rent index list with an average of €2,276 per month for a flat. Rotterdam and The Hague are in 4th and 5th place after Rome and Paris. In Rotterdam you pay €1,795 for an apartment and €1,790 in The Hague. So The Hague is €5 cheaper than Rotterdam.
But it also costs less to get a train to Amsterdam, so I guess that it all evens out.
Utrecht is 7th place with €1,746 after Munich. Munich is a bit of a surprise, I thought.
Well, it's expensive. Munich's a pretty expensive place, I think. What it says. I mean, Utrecht is nice, but I would, I don't know. If I had
you prefer
free
The
choice,
Hague,
I'd
of course.
Leave, I'd prefer The Hague, yeah.
Yeah, if you preferred Munich, I would have been worried.
Well, I've got good beer halls there.
That's right. And an excellent place to write books, I've heard.
Yes.
The research was done by Rotterdam-based Housing Anywhere. That's an international provider for medium-term rental properties. They looked at the rents of 67,000 homes in 28 European cities in the first quarter of the year. In Rotterdam, apartment rents soared nearly 16% compared to last year, while in The Hague this was over 25%. So yeah, housing prices and rental prices are really skyrocketing. Going through the roof. Then the findings of Housing Anywhere shocked the Woonbond, that's the Dutch Association for Tenants. A spokesman told NOS that they already knew that rents were high, but the fact we came out as a winner, or rather the loser, is very sad news, they said, adding that the research confirms rents are excessively high in the private sector, which must be restricted. And the Woonbond hopes that Parliament will quickly pass Housing Minister Hugo de Jonge's affordable rent bill. That bill aims at regulating the rent in mid-market homes in the private sector. Even though this precise law is one of the reasons why so few buildings are, or new dwellings are actually being built, because property investors feared that their investment will not return as quickly as in previous years. So for the building sector, this bill is not a good sign.
Yeah, but it's that age old conundrum. You know, how do you keep building houses but also keep rents down? Obviously, that is the problem at the heart of the matter, because we have this big housing shortage, and unfortunately, there's no sign that everyone is going to start building anytime soon. Right?
Oh, calm down, Daniel Koolhuis. I set you up here, I have to admit.
I know you did.
In total, 6,100 new-built homes found an owner in the final 3 months of 2024. That's a rise of 15% on the same period a year earlier. But that wasn't enough to lift the total of new builds sold to more than 16,600 over the year as a whole. So yeah, this is the lowest figure in 5 years. Prices were up 3% on 2022, according to new figures based on the Centraal Bureau for Statistiek, the Central Statistics Agency, and the Land Registry, the Kadaster. In the final 3 months of the year, the average price for a new home was €502,000, An existing property averaged 422,000. Major residential construction projects are being scrapped because they don't have enough buyers, and the number of new developments is indeed plunging. Developers usually want to sell at least 70% of the properties before work commences, and yeah, this is on very depressing news. If you are in search of a new home, and
it's hugely depressing news if you're trying to buy a house, if you're trying to rent a house. Basically, the only people who are doing well are estate agents and sellers. Yeah, assuming that you're not selling a house to buy another house, which you usually are, so almost nobody's winning.
Speaking of not winning.
Yes. Yeah. Speaking of not winning, things continue to go from bad to worse at mid-table Eredivisie club Ajax FC. Following a record 6-0 hammering by arch-rivals Feyenoord at the weekend, the club is now teetering on the brink of all-out civil war. Last week we brought you the news that Alex Kroes, the new chief executive, had been suspended after it turned out he'd bought 17,500 shares the week before his appointment was announced last August. Kroes, of course, said that this was him giving a personal vote of confidence in the club, but unfortunately the club took legal advice and they said this looks more like insider trading. So
if only Ajax was playing as creative as Ajax Kroes was in coming up with excuses, then yes.
If only Ajax's defence was anything like as Alex's Kroes' defence there was about as credible as Ajax's defence against Feyenoord at the weekend.
Exactly, yeah. You can go both ways in this. You can find a metaphor that works both ways. That's astonishing.
Yeah. It's wonderful. Yeah, so the club now wants to dismiss Alex Kroes, who has only actually worked as CEO for two weeks because he had to sit on the sidelines for 5 months. He was like on the substitutes bench because he had a non-competition clause with his previous club, AZ Alkmaar.
He even had to sit among the rest of the audience, right? He wasn't even allowed to sit on the side bench. He had to sit
had to sit in the stand like an ordinary spectator. Yeah. And of course, now that Alex Kroes as well, of course, he bought these 17,500 shares, but that was in addition to 25,000 shares in Ajax he already owned, and that's turned out to be a problem because, of course, he owned those shares when he was a director of other football clubs, AZ Alkmaar and Go Ahead Eagles. And Go Ahead Eagles was managing director was interviewed this week, and he said, "Well, actually, in most professional clubs, including us, have a clause in the contract saying that no, you're not allowed to own shares in a competing football club." So now he's in trouble, not just with the stock exchange and with Ajax, but also with the two previous clubs that he worked at. So not been a good week for Alex if you're Alex Kroes.
There are some Greek mythological persons that have been convicted to sitting on a mountaintop being visited by an eagle. So I think this mythological eagle comes from Deventer, it appears.
Yeah,
so
it's going to eat out
all his profits.
it's going to eat up Alex Kroes's credibility. But this week, 131 club members at Ajax, which is around 20% of Ajax's total membership, including several former players, wrote a letter in support of him. Accused the supervisory board and chairman Michael van Praag of carrying out a character assassination through the media, and they said the club should have waited for the financial regulator, AFM, to rule on whether his share purchases broke the law, which is also the argument that Alex Kroes has put forward. So I think he spent a lot of money, instead of on shares, on stamps this week, writing to all his friends saying, please make the case for me to the supervisory board.
And this wasn't the only setback for Ajax this week, because there was also a twist in someone called Sven Mislintat.
Yes, Sven Mislintat, who was very briefly the director of football, appointed back at last April to replace Mark Overmars, who of course left the club in disgrace after sending dick pics to his colleagues. This is how this whole...
It was the first domino to fall, basically, wasn't it?
Yes, Mark Overmars' personal domino. Mislintat was then the director of football for 5 months. months, during which he spent 100 million euros on 12 players, many of whom featured in the 6-0 defeat to Feyenoord. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's some questions about the standards of players that he recruited, but also there are questions about the actual transfer dealings themselves, because, for example, one Croatian defender that he bought had just changed his agent the day before to somebody who had a business relationship with Mislintat. So the club said this looked like a conflict of interest, and they commissioned a external inquiry by accountant bureau KPMG. Mislintat, in the meantime, was sacked, but the club insisted that was not connected to the inquiry, I think probably after taking legal advice. But this week, KPMG came back with their report, and they concluded there was no conflict of interest in Mislintat's dealings. They also criticised Ajax for giving Mislintat too much autonomy in the transfer policy and just the right to basically go out and sign whoever the hell he pleased. And that now has turned the spotlight on Ajax's financial director, Susan Lentering, because she reassured shareholders at the time that all player transfers had been carefully vetted by the entire board. And there's speculation now that she could come under pressure on a shareholders meeting on May the 21st, where Ajax, which Ajax originally convened to sack Carlos Kroos. But Gerben Everts, chair of the Shareholders Association VEB, told RTL that if you say that the conditions were properly applied, and KPMG have now come out with a report saying that's absolute rubbish, well, you've got some explaining to do. So yeah, it looks as if there might be another a couple of dominoes falling in this exciting looking meeting on May the 21st.
Troy is burning. where does this all leave Ajax? Because it's a mess in the organization. It's a mess on the field.
Yeah,
it's a mess everywhere. What is going to happen with
Ajax?
Just
in a very, very bad place. I mean, they're the richest club in the Netherlands. They really need to be in the Champions League every season to bankroll their high expenditure. But at the moment, they're sixth in the Eredivisie, which means at best they're going to get into the Conference League. And even then, they got to go through a playoffs for that. They're 33 points behind leaders PSV. They're 24 points behind Feyenoord. They've only won two of their last 10 league games, and they were knocked out of the cup by amateur side Hercules. Another Greek mythological figure. And their hopes of finding a new permanent first team coach for next season have also taken a bit of a hit.
Did they lose from? Did they lose against the team from Paris at some point or not? Recently,
they haven't played Paris lately, they probably would. Yeah. And they're also, I mean, another thing they need to do is find a new permanent first team coach, because John van Schip is only coaching the team in a temporary capacity. Mm-hmm. So they were hoping to appoint the former Chelsea manager, Graham Potter. Potter was one of Alex Kroos' favourite candidates, but Alex Kroos, unfortunately, has flown too close to the sun, like another gross Greek mythological figure, and plunged to his doom. So now Graham Potter has taken one look at the state of the club and basically decided he'd rather stay in Brexit Britain.
So he is not going to try to let Ajax raise from the ashes like a phoenix.
No. Icarus, that's what I was thinking of.
Icarus, yeah, of course. We really are... our Greek mythology is a bit rusty, even though I have to say we managed to squeeze out so many references in this segment. It is astonishing. There also is another footballing institution that's facing a challenge from within. Is it the KNVB, perhaps?
It is the KNVB, yeah. But I have to say, this is a lot less dramatic, but the KNVB had been hoping to shoo in former police chief Frank Pauw as their new chairman in a couple of weeks ago. That wasn't a universally popular decision. Many fans, especially in Amsterdam, actually are not happy with Frank Pauw because of the way he's handled some of the statements he's made in the wake of rioting by Ajax fans. But anyway, his installation was held up because Zeist, which is the KNVB's base, was chosen as the location to film The Passion, which is the annual TV dramatization of the death of Jesus.
You can't make this up.
They had to delay that by a couple of weeks, and since in the meantime, a couple of other candidates have thrown their hats into the ring, including, I think intriguingly, former Deze Zestig MP Jeanette van der Laan. The 44-year-old is also a former international footballer. She was the first girl to be allowed to play in a boys' league back in 1995. And 30 years later, she's now looking to become the first woman to chair the National Football Association. There is another candidate as well in the running, which is former Groninger managing director Hans Nyland. So, yeah, Frank Power is not necessarily got it all stitched up yet.
This is the sports segment.
We talk about politics and Greek mythology, but it's actually the sports section.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk about some actual sport. Mathieu van der Poel, our favorite Belgian Dutchman.
After
Max Verstappen, of course. He's on a bit of a hot streak at the moment because he just keeps winning, even though people are throwing hats at him.
We talked about people throwing their hats into the ring in the last section. This is more about people throwing their hats at cyclists, but that didn't put off Mathieu van der Poel, who charged a victory in Paris-Roubaix at the weekend with a 60-kilometer solo run. He finished 3 minutes clear of his Alpecin de Koninck teammate Jasper Philipsen, and that followed victory in the Tour of Flanders the weekend before. Now, on that occasion, he waited till 45 kilometers from the end to launch his winning effort. Van der Poel is the first rider since Fabian Cancellaris in 2013 to win both races in the same season, and this week he's going to try and keep his winning streak running. He starts as favourite for the Amstel Gold Race in Limburg, which is probably the biggest Dutch one-day race in the calendar, and there's speculation he could go for a hat-trick of monument wins in Luik, Bastenaak and Luik, or as it's better known, Liège, Bastogne, Liège, which is the following weekend, where he'll go head-to-head with Slovenia's Tadej Pogačar.
And the road to Robert wasn't entirely smooth, though.
No, it wasn't. And not because of the cobblestones, because it's not one of those courses, but his rear wheel was struck by a hat, which was thrown from the crowd 15 kilometres into his solo effort. And this generated a huge amount of op-ef and finger-pointing on social media. There was a great big social media hunt for the woman who's responsible. The French Cyclists Union, UNCP, have filed an official complaint with the police because the video footage indicates that she was actually leaned down and threw this hat into the rear wheel of Mathieu van der Poel. So she can, it's quite hard when you see the pictures to sort of believe that this happened somehow, it just flew accidentally out of her hand.
These kind of things rarely happen on purpose, even though Mathieu van der Poel has been victimized, I guess, or recently there were some fans specifically from Belgium who have been throwing beers at him and have been shouting names at him, so it is generally a concern of many that he's been sabotaged by people from the crowd. And of course, I think it was last year or the year before that we've seen an incident with a person with a cardboard sign, right? Mm. With Allez Opie Oma Omi or something like that, which also caused an enormous crash in the Tour de France. It is enormously dangerous, but at the same time, I think we shouldn't jump to conclusions too quickly because very often it is just an honest mistake or an accident.
And you have to say that this, you mentioned the sign that someone's thrust in front of the cyclists in the Tour de France that caused a big crash. On this occasion, nothing really happened. I mean, the hat did glance off Van der Poel's rear wheel, but he just powered on. He wasn't knocked off balance, and it had no effect on the result of the race either. So I think, we shouldn't get too hot under the collar about it.
Campaigners have won a 5-year battle to release a list of 6,000 locations where debris from a container ship was scattered on the seabed of the Waddenzee. The MS Zoe, that's one of the largest container ships in the world, shed 342 containers full of cargo after a storm blew up in the shallow sea on January 1st, 2019. I completely forgot that this happened on New Year's Day, but it was a bad start of the year because, at the end of the year, things really went south. Toys, chairs, flat screens, TVs and light bulbs littered the beaches of the North Coast and the Wadden Islands, which are a World Heritage Site, after they were washed up from the containers. The Waddenvereniging, that's a volunteer organization which monitors the area, estimates that 800 tons of debris, and that's around one quarter of the total lost, is still lying on the seabed. The Dutch government classed the lost cargo as litter, and that means that legally, there's no obligation for them to clear it up. But former infrastructure minister Cora van Nieuwenhuizen refused to publish a list of 6,000 locations where debris had been found. And this was done. This list was compiled based on research by the ship's owners. They had used underwater drones with all sorts of sonar technology to map out these locations, but they never made it public. Now the campaigners have finally won this legal battle to get this list released.
Yeah. So how did the campaigners exactly manage to overturn this decision by the minister?
There's a group called Leiden Advocacy Project on Plastic, LAP with double P. That's a group of Leiden University law students, and they work with non-governmental organizations. They had obtained the list through the Freedom of Information Procedure, WOW, or as it is still commonly known, WOP. Right, I think everyone keeps calling it WOPEN.
Everyone keeps calling it WOP, yes. It's always called a WOP-versuch, isn't it? Yeah. But they sort of restructured the regulation and gave it a different name.
Ellen Kuipers, she's of the Waddenvereniging, told Omroep Friesland, and that's if you think that I'm pronouncing this weirdly, this is because it's not Dutch, but it's actually Frisian, which was an entirely different op-ed this week.
which we chose to ignore.
She said that we're thrilled with the ruling because it means that we can search more exactly. Even though it's been 5 years since the event and things will undoubtedly have changed on the seabed, this will definitely be helpful. Conservation groups including Stichting de Noordzee, Friese Milieudefensie and Stichting Duik de Noordzee. We have so many of these organizations, right?
I love the fact that Stichting de Noordzee and Stichting Duik de Noordzee. Yeah, it's like the Judean People's Front.
Yeah. If you compile a list of all these types of organizations, it will be longer than 6,000.
It'll be longer than the list of items in the seabed,
They have all worked with the Waddenvereniging to set up the Cleanup Excel project, aiming to clear the seabed of debris within 5 years. Kuiper said that the ruling would make it easier to obtain details of future large-scale losses of cargo at sea. The shipping operator and the government must immediately publish what was in the container and where it is lying. Will probably be a lot of cocaine, I imagine. Bananas and cocaine. That goes for any impact it has on the environment, she said. It is a really important judgment.
Yeah.
So hopefully the Waddenzee will finally be clean again.
Yeah, it'll be cleared up. Yeah, but it's a curious thing. The shipping company spent all this money and went to all this effort to locate where these items were, and then claimed it was completely worthless litter. And then the Dutch government said, "Well, even though it's worthless litter, it's still commercially sensitive information." It makes no sense.
It makes absolutely no sense. And their WOW procedure was they were granted their WOW request. But I imagine that if they went to court over it, they would probably have won. It is a strange story, but it was a very dramatic incident. I remember it very well when this ship was in this storm and all these containers were being blown from the ship. Right, it was very impressive.
And like I say, it was all kinds of random objects, toys. I saw a beach just full of light bulbs as well. You know, so if it was looking at the pictures, and also the fact that the Waddenzee, which is a very sort of shallow sea and an important conservation area, is now just cluttered with all this 800 tons of debris. And of course, people out there go out vatlopen, and really the last thing you want to do is go out vatlopen and then stand on the Lego brick. You know, I think the one place in the world where you're safe from standing on Lego is the bottom of the Waddenzee.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all we have for you this week. This podcast is a production of Dutch News, which can be found online at dutchnews.nl. We'll include links to everything we talked about today in the liner notes. You can get in touch with us by email to podcast@dutchnews.nl. And if you want to help us out, please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating, or even back us on Patreon at patreon.com/dutchnewsnl. You'll earn yourself a shout out on the podcast and access to all our lovely bonus content. My thanks to Paul Peters, I'm Gordon Darroch, and next week I'll be back with Shanai Bustos.
still have, I think, when is the deadline?
I think it's 2 weeks. I think it's the 24th of April. Okay. Although I want to check that, because I don't want to be misinforming people.
Dutch News has an article explaining how you can register to vote. So we will link to that in the liner notes. And while Gordon is looking up deadline real quick, I am trying to prevent some dead air from happening, even though I've run out. Shall I just read everything? Shall I just
read everything? Or we can just cut these 2 minutes scrolling into out of the, you know how this is not actually a live podcast? Yeah.
Luckily. Thank God.
That's the end of the show outtake.